Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Temple Grandin is an advocate for people with autism, a professor of animal science at Colorado State University, and a prolific author of books and research publications. Her most recent book is Calling All Minds, How to Think and Create Like an Inventor. Temple was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2016. In 2010, a movie based on her life, starring Claire Danes as Temple, was released by HBO Films. Temple visited Traverse City in 2013 and talked with editor and media consultant Laura Hanhold on the stage of the City Opera House. At that time, Temple's book, The Autistic Brain, had recently been released. Laura asked Temple if her autism creates any special challenges for being a writer.
Well, when I did my very first book, Thinking in Pictures, one of the big problems I had was organization. You see, when you think in pictures, it's associative thinking. Okay, I want to give you an idea of how associative thinking works. Give me a keyword that's not something common like dog or house. Give me a creative keyword and I'll tell you how associative thinking works. And so I have to take a lot of precautions against rambling. What I do right now, especially when I write scientific stuff, and if you want to see some of my stuff I've written without any editing, you can go on Grandin.com and read my livestock stuff.
Check it out later. Okay, rocket.
Rocket. Okay, I'm seeing the space shuttle taking off. I'm seeing the Soyuz taking off. I'm seeing model rockets that I had when I was a kid. And Model Rocket Club was one of the few places where I wasn't teased when I was in high school. So now I'm seeing kids tease me. Okay, see how I got from rocket to being teased? This Model Rocket Club was the only place I was not teased. You know, now I'm seeing other activities that I did in high school where I was not teased, like riding horses and electronics lab.
So rocket brings good pictures to
you. Yeah, that's good memories because I was an Estes model rocketeer, and those were good times.
Sure. Chickens.
Chickens. I'm seeing a KFC store. I just got back from Thailand. I do animal welfare work for McDonald's, and I was training 60 people from their Asia Pacific region on how to audit chicken slaughter plant, and beef slaughter plant, pork slaughter plant for animal welfare. So I'm seeing that. Now I'm getting scenes from Thailand, seeing the hotel we were staying at, different places we went to.
Are you seeing what Carrie ate for dinner tonight?
Yes, I'm seeing my chocolate raspberry thing, and I see it first, and then I taste it. My memory's visually indexed. So even if you ask me about a smell, I see the thing that makes the smell before I smell it.
So you see the picture, and
that's
then you're
right
back in time, and then maybe you're smelling it and
hearing
it.
Yeah, then I can smell it, yeah. But the picture always comes up first.
Yeah. So I want to come back, because you were saying that a big challenge for you with writing is organization.
Well, I have to use outlines. What I have to do now, and I learned a lot from Betsy Lerner, one of the editors for Thinking in Pictures, was make an outline. I can't do more than two double-spaced pages without another outline header to stop rambling. And that's what I do now. I do if I do a review article on cattle handling, and you can look some of that stuff up on Grandin.com, is I got to have a whole lot of outline headers. Mm-hmm. And then that stops rambling.
And where do you get your book ideas? Like your idea for this book, for instance?
Well, the main thing that got that book going was I'd done all these brain scans over the years. So I thought it'd be interesting to kind of go through my odyssey of brain scans. But then the other big part of that book is the different kinds of minds. Now I've talked about this before in things like my TED talk, you know, visual thinkers like me, mathematical thinkers, word thinkers. But in the autistic brain, I actually found scientific research that backs up that there's two kinds of visual thinking. There's the object photorealistic visual thinking like me, more the art mind or industrial designer mind. And then you have the more pattern thinker, visual spatial, where you're located in space, that's your mathematical mind. And they actually use different brain systems, and there's been studies that show that there really are these two kinds of thinking. And when you get diagnoses like autism or dyslexia or ADHD, you tend to have more uneven kinds of skills. You know, I had observed this for years, but in the autistic brain, I found the I did some surfing one night on the internet, and I found a whole treasure trove of papers that backed up what I was saying.
Now, your brain scans, which are shown in this book, you show pictures. You as a visual thinker, are your brain scans different from the pattern thinker or the verbal thinker?
Well, we haven't gotten to that point. Now, I've got some big extra visual circuits. If you go on USA Today, type in USA Today Temple Grandin, you can really see a big circuit sprawls all around the brain. I got some cerebral spinal fluid in the left parietal area that kind of really wrecked math. You know, you might ask, well, why am I doing all these scans?
Too,
well, you know, why do people explore? You know, you want to look. So a new kind of scanner comes available, so you take a look. And I get asked all the time, well, is what you show up in those brain scans, is that your destiny? I think that innate abilities have the biggest effect on the extreme ends of the spectrum. Like you got some individuals with autism that are not going to be able to talk. You got some third graders that are math geniuses. And those third graders need to be advanced forward in math and not held back. Middle of the road people, you know, maybe Malcolm Gladwell's more right there. A lot of practice and access to the resources. But I think on the extreme ends of the spectrum, that's where innate abilities do matter. When 1968, I had access to the same computer that Bill Gates had access. I wanted to program it, I just couldn't do it. You know, but visual things, that's the stuff that I excel in. You know, I'm a big believer in build up on the kid's strength. Right. My ability in art showed up in around third or fourth grade. My mother always encouraged my ability in art, and I was encouraged to do lots of different projects, not just the same horse heads over and over again.
Yeah. I want to talk about your childhood a little bit, because as people might know, you started out not speaking.
No speech until age four.
And some doctors advised your parents to put you in an institution.
Well, I was the kind of kid that back in the 50s, they just took kids like me and put me in an institution. But fortunately, my mother went to a really good neurologist in Boston that referred her to a little speech therapy school that two teachers taught out of their basement of their house. And I got the same kind of therapy that they're doing today. Now, you take kids on the milder end of the spectrum. I can think of kids I went to school with that would be labeled mild autism or Asperger. This is the kid where there's no speech delay, but they're socially awkward. And they've always been here.
Yeah. And do you remember learning to talk?
I can remember the frustration not being able to get my speech out. I had a hard time getting it out. And one thing that showed up in the brain scans is that I had there was less bandwidth in my circuits for speak what I see and speak what I hear. Circuits are smaller. And I couldn't get speech out. You know, it's very, very frustrating.
Which may be why you're having tantrums.
Well,
also.
Yeah, if you can't communicate, you're going to have tantrums.
Yeah. And do you remember feeling relief when you were finally able to communicate?
Well, my speech came in slowly.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't like all of a sudden. And then you have another kind of kid that's echolalic. They can yak out all these TV commercials, all these scripts off of things, but they don't know what it means. In other words, speech output's working fine. I had trouble with getting speech out. Echolalic kid yaks it out, but the meaning in the brain is not hooked up. It's something different. Yeah.
And so after you became verbal, you went to general ed schools, right?
Yes, I did. I went to a small elementary school. It was a little private school. I had 12 kids in the class. It was a regular ed school. And mother and the principal got together, and they just decided that they could work with me. And, you know, old-fashioned 50s classroom, you know, that worked for me.
Yeah, and you say this, and I think it's interesting, you credit a lot of where you are today to that 50s upbringing.
Well, in the 50s upbringing, manners were pounded into kids, and mother had a really good idea how much to stretch me. I'm seeing too many kids today, well, little Timmy doesn't know how to order a hamburger at McDonald's. Little Timmy doesn't know how to shake hands. See, those things just have to be taught. And when I was like 8 years old, I'd put on my Sunday school dress, and I'd shake hands with my mother's dinner guests and serve them hors d'oeuvres. You see, and that was really good for learning social skills. And there's a scene in the HBO movie where I go up and I get the editor's card to get my first article in the Farm Arrangement. I actually did that. And people say, well, how did you have the guts to do that? I think some of that goes back to serving hors d'oeuvres at my mother's dinner parties.
And you said you talk about having such a hard time in high school, how you were...
Oh, teasing, horrible, worst part of my life. Had to be taken out of a regular high school. Got kicked out of ninth grade because of...
So you were expelled?
Yeah, I was expelled from a large girls' school for throwing a book at a girl who teased me. She called me a retard.
She deserved it.
And I ended up I ended up going to a special boarding school for gifted kids with problems. And for the first 2 years I was there, they didn't make me do much studying, but boy, did I learn how to work. I took care of the horse barn. In fact, Mother had me working even before I went to the school. When I was 13, she had me doing a little sewing job 2 afternoons a week. I'm a big believer in teaching kids work skills. So for the first 2 years at the boarding school, I didn't do any work. But one place where they drew a line in the sand, I wasn't allowed to become a recluse in my room. I had to come to meals, had to come to classes even though I didn't study, and when I didn't want to go to Friday night movie night, they gave me the choice I could be the projectionist. I was going to go, and I could either be the projectionist or just sit in the seats, but not going was not going to be an option. See, I was given a choice,
right?
But staying in my room was not going to be one of the choices.
Yeah, and you say that your two hardest subjects were algebra.
Oh, algebra is like totally impossible. One of the big mistakes made in my math education is we didn't go to geometry. That was a gigantic mistake, because I'm seeing a number of individuals that fail algebra and they can do geometry and trig and sometimes even calculus. And so I recommend that if you have a kid that's terrible in algebra, just jump to geometry and see if he can do geometry. And that wasn't done with me. Yeah. Now, I had a terrible time with like physics word problems, because I have problems holding one piece of information in my head while I manipulate another piece of information.
Yeah.
And so how did I do my design stuff? Well, I had to design hydraulic equipment. Oh, there's tables. There's whole books full of tables, and I had them.
And it was also at this boarding school where you met one of your most important mentors, Mr. Carlock. He's Dr. Carlock in the movie.
Yeah, he got an honorary doctorate. And he actually was a NASA space scientist, and he gave me a lot of interesting projects to do. This is where a mentor teacher can really turn a kid around. And one of the things I think so bad that they're doing in the schools now is they're taking out the hands-on classes. When I was in elementary school, sewing and art were my favorite things, and then I got to take wood shop. Then all through high school, all the hands-on things. I think taking the hands-on classes out, like auto mechanics and welding and wood shop, and it's absolutely the worst thing. In fact, I just talked to you. I talked to a young man on the airplane just today that he installs plastic injection molding equipment, and he says one of the classes he really liked in school was, he took 3 different classes at auto shop and welding and a design invention course, and then he got into a good career in the plastics industry.
Yeah, and more schools are getting rid of those classes.
And I think that's a huge mistake, because right now we have a shortage of diesel mechanics, auto mechanics, certified welders, a lot of these very skilled hands-on trades, and I loved that kind of stuff. And I think taking those classes out is really wrong. And I think also those classes teach practical problem solving. They teach a resourcefulness. If you mess up a project, how do you fix your project?
Right. And at school, you also were responsible for taking care of the horses, right?
Yeah, I cleaned 8 horse stalls every day. I put the horses in and out of the barn. I fed the horses. I was very proud of the fact that I basically was managing a horse barn. And that was something I just gravitated towards, and the school let me do it. And I was learning work skills. I'm seeing too many kids today in the diagnosis not learning any work skills. And then when I see a lot of the people on the spectrum that are my age, that succeeded, they had paper routes when they were kids. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to start teaching work skills at around 12 or 13. And since the paper routes are gone, they could walk some dogs for the neighbors. They could be a tour guide at a local museum. They could help an old lady, 2 times a week buy her groceries. Kids need to learn some discipline of work skills. Right. And that's something, I think it's one of the reasons why at my boarding school they let me clean so many horse stalls. Because I wasn't doing much studying, but boy, I did learn how to work.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Temple Grandin talks about how being a visual thinker helped her solve problems for the cattle industry.
Thank you.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Laura Honhold's conversation with Temple Grandin.
And it was also when you were a teenager that you started visiting your aunt's farm, which was also, I mean, that was really, truly life-changing.
Well, that's right. And originally, I was afraid to go to my aunt's ranch when I had the opportunity at age 15. And Mother gave me a choice. I could go for a week, and if I didn't like it, I could come back, or I could go for all summer. Not going wasn't going to be an option. She gave me a choice. It's just like the thing with the movie night. I could either sit in the seats or I could be a projectionist. But I wasn't going to not go.
And it was there that you developed an affinity for the cattle.
Well, I got really interested in the cattle squeeze chute because I noticed when cattle went in the cattle squeeze chute to get vaccinated, that sometimes the cattle just relaxed. So I went and tried out the squeeze chute, and the pressure helped calm me down. And I was super nervous, and I got into puberty, horrible, horrible anxiety attacks. That's now controlled with a low dose of antidepressant medication. And in my book, Thinking and Pictures, I got a chapter called Believer in Biochemistry. And that's where I talk about my experiences with antidepressants. And in the movie, I was eating all this yogurt and Jell-O. Well, that's because I had colitis attacks. Well, that all stopped when I went on the antidepressants. It's got to be a low dose. You take too high a dose, you'll get agitation and insomnia.
You got it down to, you got it all figured out.
Yeah.
So the cattle chute, you went into it and you noticed that it calmed you.
Yeah, that's
right. And it freaked out your aunt, right?
Well, then I built a, you know, device I could get into that applied pressure. But there's a certain segment of people on the autistic spectrum where deep pressure over big parts of the body calms them down. And another thing that helped calm me down was getting lots of exercise. That was another thing that helped me.
Yeah, and you went on to develop your squeeze box.
That's right. I developed the squeezing thing I could get into, and that helped help calm me down.
Yeah. And where was it that you were having trouble having it in your room, at high school or college?
Well, yeah, the movie kind of exaggerated a little bit. It didn't get thrown in the garbage can. It actually got put in storage, and people thought that was really weird. See, people back then did not understand the sensory issues. And one of the areas where I think research is really needed, people on autism spectrum, but also with some of the other labels, is sensory issues. Problems with things like sound sensitivity, problems with seeing flicker of fluorescent lights. I still can't stand scratchy clothing. It's like sandpaper against my skin. And sensory oversensitivities can vary from a nuisance to being very debilitating. And if there's one thing I think really they need to be doing research on, it's on that. And the problem is, you can't diagnose it just based on autism. Because if you have 20 people with autism, maybe only two of them have a problem with fluorescent lights. So if you want to do research on it, you've got to pick out the people that just have problems with fluorescent lights. And some kids that are dyslexic have trouble with fluorescent lights, and they say they see the print jiggle on the page. And sometimes that can be helped by using different colored paper and different pale pastel tinted
glasses.
Yeah,
that's so interesting. You write about it, and I think Thinking in Pictures, how just changing the color of paper could help someone who's having trouble reading.
Well, I've had students that tan paper helped them. Another student was helped with lavender paper. You've got to pick out the color that works for you.
So your sensitivity to what's around you, that was a huge influence in your work then with livestock.
Well, when I first started doing work with livestock, I noticed that cattle would stop if they refused to go through a chute. They saw a shadow. They saw a chain hanging down. They saw a reflection. They saw a car parked next to the facility. You know, little distractions that we tend to not notice scared the cattle. And I was one of the first people to notice that. And people looked at me like I was crazy. But you see, that's seeing visual detail. Most people don't see it. And, 40 years later, I still got to, show slides to my students of a chain hanging down in a chute. Say, well, take that chain out of there because people don't see it. I have to train them to see it. In my book on humane livestock handling, I've got checklists of all the different distractions they need to look for. I get asked all the time, do the cattle know they're going to get slaughtered? I found they behave exactly the same way at the slaughterhouse as they do in the veterinary chute. And if you remove the distractions, then they'll walk right up the chute in the slaughterhouse. Believe you me, they did not want to go in there at all. You'd never get them in there.
Yeah, because people were really, if not mishandling the cattle, truly not getting them, not figuring out what they needed. And
oh,
they need to move in circular motion.
Well, you see, cattle like to go back to where they come from. And another advantage of, like, if you have a curved crowding pen, is they come around the bend, they think they're going back to where they come from. And then getting all the distractions out of there is so important. I'm still amazed at how I can go into a plant and with a portable light to light up something that's too dark, or I cover something up with cardboard so they don't see people walking by, or I move a light to get rid of a reflection. It still kind of blows my mind how well that works. I call it, you know, my lights and cardboard trick.
Yeah. I'm amazed. Here's my bill.
Well, but you got to know where to put the light and where to put the cardboard. That's the thing.
Wow. Well, there's a very well-known New Yorker art profile of you by Oliver Sacks,
yes.
Which then became the title of his book, taken from a phrase that you used to refer to yourself, an anthropologist on Mars. And tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I don't pick up subtle social cues, you know, just the very subtle things. I didn't even know that people sort of had all these little secret eye signals until I read about them in a book. You know, today these books are available, but when I was young, they just weren't available.
And one of the things that you didn't pick up on is the whole notion of romantic love. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know. I still, like, one time ago, I was on a flight recently, and there was I was in the window seat, and this couple was really having a great time in the other two seats, and they were they were looking in each other's eyes, and there was some kind of electricity going on there, and I'm like an anthropologist studying that. You know, I was reading the newspaper, but I was not totally reading the newspaper.
Yeah, well, what you said, it was like Romeo and Juliet, what's the big deal? I don't get it.
Well, I can remember when I was in high school, I had a roommate, and she just had a crush on the Beatles. And I can remember when the Beatles first came on the Ed Sullivan Show, and she was rolling around on the floor squealing, and I'm going, yeah, I think Ringo's cute, but I'm not going to roll around on the floor.
So when you were in high school, who were you idolizing?
Well, I was very interested in the space program. I just worshiped the astronauts. You know, that was the kind of stuff that interested me. In fact, Mr. Carlock, my science teacher, had worked for NASA on spacesuit design. So that also added, another added area of interest there.
So he was an engineer for NASA?
You know, he was a designer. And, he'd worked for one of the companies working on spacesuits prior to coming to my school.
And you went to college very close to your boarding school.
Yeah, what happened is I hadn't done much studying, and then in the last year I kind of pulled up my grades, and Mother and the headmaster at Hampshire Country School got together with Clifford Coles and Frank DiPietro over at Franklin Pierce College, and I kind of they arranged it so I could come in on probation. And I came in and I got good grades. By this I took school seriously. I did not miss classes. I got up in the morning, went to classes. I remember Mother telling me, remember, each class is the cost of an expensive theater ticket. And I never forgot that.
And not only did you finish college, you went to Arizona State University.
Went to Arizona State, got my master's at Arizona State.
And you did research work there, started working with cattle then?
Well, and then I had, my advisor didn't really like the idea of all this cattle shoot stuff. And in the movie, they changed the thesis to mooing. See, the vocalization research I did later. But one of the reasons they had to change it is because the people that are still alive, you can't depict. So originally I was going to do my thesis on was different kinds of cattle chutes and how that affected cattle handling. And so my advisor had said, oh, you can't do cattle chutes, that's not academic. So I had to get a new advisor, and he was Foster Burton over at the construction department, and Michael Nielsen from the industrial design department. Because what I do with visual thinking is industrial design. And I'm getting very concerned that all of this emphasis on STEM is going to block out us visual thinkers. But let me tell you, the engineers need us, because the Fukushima nuclear power plant would not have burnt down if it had been a visual thinker on the staff, because when I found out why those plants melted down, I couldn't believe it. They went and put their emergency generator that runs a super important emergency cooling pump in a non-waterproof basement. I'm not kidding. And those big diesels drowned, and the pump and the electric boards all drowned along with it, and that's why we had, you know, the worst reactor accidents in history due to a visual thinking mistake. I can't make a nuclear reactor, but I would not make that mistake. Let's look at Steve Jobs. He was an artist. And he worked with the engineers to make the inside of the phone and the iPad work.
You say a number of times in your books that people who are primarily verbal people, like myself, you know, we're missing this very obvious stuff because we're so busy thinking verbally rather than
seeing. What I find is that people that think verbally tend to overgeneralize. It just blows my mind, whether I don't care whether I'm doing an animal behavior talk or I'm doing an autism talk, when people ask me questions, it's so overgeneralized, I can't possibly answer it. They'll say things like, my child has behavior problems in the classroom, or my dog is crazy. And I get these kind of questions all the time. Well, I don't even know how old this child is. I don't know what kind of a problem he has. Now, if it's little kids that are nonverbal, I can just say tons of early intervention. But once you get past that point, there's no way I can answer behavior issues in the classroom without asking a lot more questions, find out exactly what the child's doing in the classroom. Or the dog is crazy. Well, is it a happy little dog jumping on you? Or is it a dog that's biting people? I've got to know what it was doing and when and where it was doing it.
Right.
People tend to overgeneralize.
Yeah, you talk about in one of your books the video where people are at a basketball game and they're so intent on the game that they miss the lady in the gorilla suit running around the sidelines.
Yeah, and you can actually look that video up on YouTube. It's called the lady in the gorilla suit. Now, of course, if you know, been told about it, you're going to see it. What they were told to do is to count how many baskets were shot. And if they don't know this video, most people don't see the lady in the gorilla suit run by because it's so busy counting the baskets.
Wow. So you, I'm so interested in how you started your career. You started your career back in the 60s as an autistic woman in a very macho profession.
Well, actually, my career stuff really started more in the 70s. Started out with going out to feed yards and just handling cattle. And there's a scene in the movie where they put bull testicles on my car. That happened.
So that really happened.
That happened. I was kicked out of Scottsdale feed yard. Now it's the real name of the feed yard, and we could use the real name because it was torn down like 30 years ago. And then it shows me going up to the farm arrangement editor and getting his card. I actually did that. So I started out one little article in the farm arrangement at a time. Then I got a press pass, which enabled me to get into big national meetings when they came to Phoenix. Meetings with expensive $600, $500 registration fees. You know, I realized the value of that press card. So then I would go up to the editor of a national magazine and ask to do articles. And then I started out one little project at a time. I worked for a while at a feedlot construction company. And there's a scene in the movie where my boss slams down the deodorant and says, "You stink, use it." That actually happened. The secretaries did buy me better clothes. You know, they'll get me cleaned up. And things started out very slowly, one thing at a time. And one thing I learned was to sell my work rather than myself. And in the HBO movie, there's a drawing on the desk when I'm trying to sell them the guys the system that has cattle animated over it. That's one of my actual drawings. See, when you're a weird geek, the way you sell yourself is showing off your work. And people would look at my drawings and they'd go, "Wow, you designed that?" Then I got respect. You sell your work rather than yourself. That was something I learned really, really early on.
Yeah, and there's one guy in the movie, I presume he's no longer living since he's not portrayed very kindly, the sexist guy who didn't want you around.
Oh yes, that actually happened. That happened. That scene was really real.
So you like that? I mean, that movie, it was a great movie.
Well, the projects in the movie were accurate. All of, like, the gate you could open from the car, the dip vat, squeeze machine, the optical illusion room. I actually did all those projects. Those are accurate.
Mm-hmm. You said, I don't know if it was at Arizona State or your doctorate program, where you were studying pigs.
Yeah, that was my doctorate.
Your doctorate. And I thought it was so touching. You had to euthanize your piglets that you were studying.
Yeah.
And I imagine that was hard for you.
Yeah, that was.
And so how is it going day after day when you are working your livestock job?
Well, I get to thinking about, you know, like, well, I think about, like, you know, going to the slaughter plant and the cattle die. Now, of course, everything dies eventually. You know, one thing it kind of has done is made me look at my own mortality. Hope I've done some things. My life hasn't just been trivial. And we got to remember that those cattle would never be born unless we raised those cattle. They would have never have existed at all. But we've got to give those animals a life that's worth living. I feel very, very strongly about that. And now what I'm seeing, some of the biggest problems is, I've got to fix things out at the farm. The slaughterhouses were the easiest thing to fix. In fact, if you want to see how plants work, you can go on YouTube and go to Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin and Pork Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. And you can see how this stuff
works.
Don't
miss it. What are your thoughts about factory farming in general?
Well, I think there's some things that they need to change, but you can't totally get rid of large-scale farming. There are some real extreme confinement things like gestation stalls where the sow can't turn around while she's pregnant. They're really jammed in small battery cages. But I just don't think we can put every pig outside and every chicken, outside and things like that. And there are some good alternative systems like electronic sow feeders, group housing. You do have to change the genetics of the sow because we've gone all these years with the sows that live in a box, so there'd been no genetic selection. For girls that would get along with each other, you have to do a little genetic selection. And there's some new colony house systems. It still is a cage type system, but they have some amenities that hens want, like a private nest box. Hens like to hide when they lay their egg. That's a natural instinct. When they lived in the wild, the hen that hid didn't get eaten by the fox. Give them perches, give them a little place to scratch on. There's some things that need to be changed. In fact, if you want to see the hen cam, you can go into U.S. West Poultry. You can also look up some of these new systems on the Big Dutchman website. I was there yesterday. I got to do a talk next week to food service providers, and they want to see what these systems look like. So I was getting pictures off the internet.
Do you notice a difference in basically the treatment of animals, cattle versus sheep versus chickens? It seems like chickens have an especially tough
life.
Well,
the things where there's been most controversial of the animals has been sow gestation stalls. And you need to differentiate between a gestation stall and a farrowing. Farrowing stall is where she has the piglets. The gestation stall is where she lives when she's pregnant. And in the gestation stall, she can't turn around for the whole time that she's pregnant. And that's just a degree of confinement that 2/3 of the public just are not going to accept. And you need to get rid of it. And then the other thing is really small chicken cages where they're so cramped the chicken can't even stand up with a normal posture. In the new colony house, a chicken can walk with its normal posture like that. They'll line up and wait their turn for the private nest box. And it's still an intensive system, but I'm going to call it decent apartment living for chickens. And what I can see happening is the industry is going to kind of morph into two segments. You're going to have a large-scale commercial, an improved large-scale commercial, and then you're going to have your various specialty markets, outdoor chickens and things like that. But we're not going to be able to get eggs for our low-income folks from some of those outdoor chicken systems. Right. We've got a lot of low-income folks in this country, and I think eggs are a necessity. They're not a luxury, they're a necessity. And the problem is, if we get too crazy in this country, where we do stuff that just isn't practical, the industry's going to go off in other countries. Do you know that half of all the eggs you eat is a liquid egg? It's in bakery goods and things like that. And I'm really concerned about, this is going in another country, and then you can't control what's going on.
Right. And could you ever see a day where we're not eating meat, where we're making meat? Like there are those test tube hamburgers in the news.
First of all, making mammalian protein, I can't think of a dumber thing to do. Because, and the reason for that is that you have mammals have to maintain that body temperature and eat a lot more food. If you want to make protein artificially, you'd be better off just genetically engineer some scallops with no shells. And they can grow in cold water. And that would make a lot more sense than trying to make mammalian protein. Because a mammal has to eat twice as much to maintain the warm-blooded compared to a scallop. Mm-hmm. And there's no animal welfare issues with scallops. There's not enough nervous system there to worry about.
Yeah.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Laura Hahnholdt's conversation with Temple Grandin.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Laura Hanhold's conversation with Temple Grandin.
Now, you live in Fort Collins,
yes,
Colorado, where you teach.
Colorado State University in the Department of Animal Science. I teach a course in livestock handling. Been doing that for 23 years. I have my students actually design a facility. And I'm getting more and more students now that are pre-vet, maybe pre-pet veterinarian. They're not going to need to design a cattle facility. But having them actually design this, it's practical problem solving. And I think that's a good thing for people to learn. It isn't, there's various different ways you can lay it out that will work.
Yeah, it's hands-on, the type of thing you're talking about.
And then I also have an internet assignment where I make them pick out a real narrow subject in animal behavior. And they can pick anything in animal behavior, but it's going to be narrow. Because they got to learn how to dig deep into the databases and use things like the citations on Google Scholar. And I'm finding about a third of the students have no idea how to do that. I have another third where that's a good assignment, and then I have another third where this is kind of an elementary assignment. But for two-thirds of the students, my internet searching project's really good, and they got to give me two journal articles off of PubMed, two off of Web of Science, two off of Google Scholar, and two off of ScienceDirect on a narrow subject that they can pick.
Wow. Are you a hard grader?
I'm not all that bad of a grader. I'm very tough on students that cut classes. I say, I got to be here. I said, I'll come in, fly in, teach the class,
That's
turn
right.
right around and go to the airport again. I got to be here. No, you got to be here. It's like a job. You got to be here. And then the other thing is I tell them, if you turn your homework in early and I don't like your homework, you can redo it. But I still find that two-thirds of the class turns it in on the last day.
And I imagine
say,
that.
And I tell them, I said, now after that, there's no excuses. I've only excused two students. A broken leg I excused, and a death in the family I excused that. But other than that, no chance to change it if they turn it in on the last day.
Mm-hmm.
Two-thirds of them still wait until the last day.
Yeah. But I bet you're popular. Your class is always...
Yep. And I want my students to learn, and I really emphasize observation. I really emphasize the, what's this animal looking at? And I'll show, I've got a picture of the entrance to a big beef packing plant. Shows a cattle going up the chute. And I ask the students to tell me some things about this picture. And they say, yeah, there's a chain hanging down. But about over half the people don't see three people standing right where they should not be standing, right in front of the cattle. Sometimes the most obvious is the least obvious.
All right. And what do your students go on to do typically,
professionally? A lot of students will go on to be veterinarians. A lot of them will go on, you know, ranching, work in various industries, you know, livestock industries and stuff. That's what a lot of them do. Then I also have some students from equine, and some of those stay in equine, and therapeutic riding is getting really popular. In fact, CSU is planning to build a therapeutic riding center named after me, which I'm really proud of. And And it needs some donations. You can contact the Colorado State University Equine Sciences Department.
There's something you talk about, I think it's in Thinking in Pictures, that I think is so interesting. You say genius is an abnormality, and you cite a study from the University of Iowa that found 80% of creative writers have had mood disorders at some point.
That's right, and then there's some other...
All you writers out there.
Simon Baron Cohen found that people on the autism spectrum have more relevance in technical careers. You know, the thing is, these diagnostic things are a continuum. Diagnosis is not precise. I mean, parents will say, well, is my kid PDD-NOS, or is he autistic, or is he Asperger's? You know what? These things are not precise, and they've been changing over the years. Got a whole chapter in the autistic brain just on how they change the diagnosis. It's not precise, and people get locked into these labels. And I get concerned, especially with kids on the milder end of the spectrum, kind of getting so much into these labels that they aren't getting pushed enough to do things like working, learning how to shake hands, learning how to just do stuff. You got to stretch these kids. The mother had a really good sense of how do you stretch them. You can't just chuck them into surprises. Surprises cause panic, but you got to stretch. Like, she wasn't going to let me not go to the ranch. I had a choice. You know, 2 weeks or all summer. Not going was not going to be one of the choices.
Yeah.
And I've had other parents say, well, my kid didn't want to go to sleepaway camp. And then he went and he loved it. You got to stretch them. And I'm seeing too many of them not getting stretched. Autism is such a big spectrum. I think it's difficult for educators to shift gears from the nonverbal population up to a mild Asperger that should be working for Silicon Valley. And half the people in Silicon Valley have got some degree of Asperger's.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just, well, you know, look up stuff on YouTube. You know, the heads of these big Silicon Valley companies. I think Steve Jobs is on the spectrum, but I will not name the live ones. You can look them up and find their videos on YouTube and decide for yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's so interesting because you think about so many creative people in history and they who likely
were on
the spectrum. Well,
that's a good Einstein had no language till age 3. What would happen to little Albert in today's school system? How many drugs would little Albert get on? What happened to little Steve Jobs? A weird loner who brought snakes to school and turned them loose, had no friends. And the thing that saved him when he was teased in high school was going to a new high school, which was the Cupertino Valley, Cupertino High School, where Apple's located. And he got in with the local teenage kids' computer club. And this is why I'm a big advocate of getting kids that are kind of quirky and different into things with shared interests. It could be Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, agriculture programs, art programs, the school play, school newspaper, band. You know, these are the things that can really keep some of these kids going, get them into those shared interest things, because that's where their friends are going to be.
I wanted to ask you about friends. What was it like for you growing up with friends versus, you know, and how you developed?
When I was a youngster, actually, I had a good childhood because, you know, kids, I did lots of projects. We'd go build tree houses together and stuff like that. But when I got into high school, the girls weren't interested in those sort of things. And that's where I really got into trouble. And then when I went to boarding school, had those kind of interests again. I wasn't interested in the normal, you know, girls' high school stuff. Teenage years, worst part of my life. I'm seeing too many kids when they're teenager getting tortured. And I think some of these kids, you got to pull them out of school. But that doesn't mean they become a recluse at home. You pull them out of school, let them finish up online, but they need to get working.
Can animals have autism?
Well, you get situations where an animal is in a very deprived environment and will start doing repetitive behavior that looks similar to autism. But that's caused by putting it in an environment that just doesn't give enough stimulation. There are some mouse models for autism that seem to react to some drugs and stuff in a similar way. The one thing where I don't think there's an animal model for is schizophrenia. That I think that's the price we pay for language. But other things like depression, anxiety, that's the same in animals. Obsessive compulsive disorders, the same in animals.
And
it responds to the same medications.
Yeah, and because of animals in captivity that might develop this stress, you're focusing now more on your livestock work toward humane treatment of animals as opposed to the livestock engineering of the systems, is that correct?
Well, I'm still doing engineering stuff, but when I first started out, I thought that I could fix everything with equipment. I believed that in the 70s. Then I started training employees, and then I have managers untrain them. Then I got to where I'm training managers. Now I spend a lot of time with people like McDonald's, because a big buyer like that's in a position, using the economic buying power, to really bring about changes. I've always said, heat softens steel, and then I can bend it into pretty grill work. There's been some really disgusting undercover videos that are out there, really awful stuff going on. And some of the activist groups will imply that everybody treats animals like that. Well, that's like saying everybody's a drunk driver. Okay, you could go out and get horrible pictures of car accidents. Well, that doesn't mean that everybody's a drunk driver. You know, there's awful pictures out there beating up dairy cows and beating up pigs. Well, that's sort of the animal equivalent to drunken driving. I mean, most places are not doing that. And animal handling's gotten a whole lot better. Boy, I can remember the bad old days in the meat plants, broken equipment, they never fixed anything. And then in 1999, I worked on the McDonald's audits, and I saw more change. You know, now the USDA's got a website showing how many plant suspensions they got. But if that website had been around 20 years ago, it would have had 10 times more bad stuff on it than it's got now. See, this is something that people don't realize some of the improvements that have taken place.
Do you have a favorite? Are cows your favorite animal?
Beef cattle is my favorite animal.
How come?
Well, you know, people tend to like the animal that they work with the most, because I know lots of people where pigs are their favorite animal. And beef cattle was, you know, the agricultural animal that we started working with first. We started working with it. We did have dairy cows at my high school, and I did learn how to milk them by hand.
I want to get back a little bit to what might be causes of autism. You know, you talk about how it's probably, we don't really know exactly. It's probably a combination of genetics and environment.
Well, the genetics is complicated. Tons of little tiny code variations in brain, in code involved with brain development. It's a complicated quagmire. One thing that is showing up is that a deficiency of things like folic acid, you know, at the time of conception or an early pregnancy can increase developmental problems. You know, there's also concerns about some environmental contaminants interacting with susceptible genetics. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the mild autism is just increased detection. Because I can think of kids I went to school with that would be on the, definitely would have been labeled Asperger's today. In fact, in the diagnostic manual, fifth version, they're taking out Asperger's and replacing it with social communication disorder. But it's still the same thing. They're saying, well, that's not autism. But I think they're doing that to try to cut down on the amount of people they have to do services for. See, one of the problems they got in the schools today that in order to get any services, you have to have a diagnosis. And I get worried on some of these really mild kids, them getting held back. And, you know, it's difficult for schools to kind of just do the informal stuff. Like, okay, this little kid's really good in math. Well, let's let him take a Udacity class online in the third grade. And I talked to a teacher today in the airport, and this really upset me. And she said that she'd let a first grader go into her third grade, and she got chewed out by the principal. And I said, if that third grader can do sixth grade math, he can do it. Just bring a sixth grade math book into the first grade classroom and let him do it. Don't hold him back. We got a shortage right now of software engineers. One of the reasons we got a shortage of software engineers is we hold back these little math kids, and then they spin off their wheels and turn into a behavior problem. Because you made them do boring stuff over and over again. I was not one of the little math kids. I was one of the little art kids. And that was really encouraged because the field that I do with the cattle, that's actually really a field called industrial design. Mm-hmm. You know, you have engineers working on design stuff, and then you have industrial designers. And what I do is basically industrial design.
And do you still create art for pleasure? To draw or paint?
Well, I haven't been. I've been, just all I can do to keep up with all the stuff I'm doing and still work with my graduate students.
Yeah.
We just finished up some interesting research on looking at how mama cows, individual differences in how mama cows defend their calves. Some are much more vigilant and defend their calf more than others do.
Some are slacker cows?
No, there are slacker cows. In fact, out of about 200 cows, there was 3 cows that could care less about their calf. That's not good. The coyotes and the wolves are going to eat those calves.
Yeah. What do you, when you're, I know you're on the road all the time, but when you're home, what do you watch when you watch TV?
Classic Star Trek. Oh, I was an absolute Star Trek fan.
Because you sort of related to Mr. Spock.
I relate to Mr. Spock because he was logical. And the other thing that was good about Star Trek is that it actually had really good underlying, you know, good morality themes and ethical themes. Well, I watched 60 Minutes. That's when I pay bills during 60 Minutes.
No other shows, no Walking Dead or?
No, I bet I read about them. I spend a lot of time on planes reading. I'll buy 3 newspapers, a Business Week and a Time, and then on a long flight, I get all of those read. I really, you know, I just vacuum up information.
And so it's true, there's that scene in the movie where you're looking at your French textbook and you basically have instant recall with that.
Well,
you like
it
that,
isn't
or?
Quite so sudden, but when I can remember my biology notes, when I took my biology exams, I could actually see the notebook in my mind and read my notes off the notebook. I'm not able to do that as well as I used to be able to do that. Now, if there was something secret, boy, I'd remember that. I remember one time down in Australia, they had this secret cattle handling system, and I wasn't supposed to see it. And I got to see it for like 5 seconds, and that got remembered.
Well, it's funny because you You speak at one point in one of your books how you can't lie. You're unable to lie, but it seems like you're a little sneaky. You know, tell the flying saucer story from school.
Well, I can't lie unrehearsed. Oh yeah, I pulled a great flying saucer hoax in high school. And I made a flying saucer out of cardboard, kind of, you know, classic 50s style with a dome on top. That was a Dairy Queen dish with a light in it. And I got up on the roof of our building and I had painted a wire with black ink and I had it on the end of a pole. And when Jackie and Becky, these two other girls, had just turned out their lights, I went, I swung it in front of the window. They didn't see it. Then I swung it in front of the window again and they screamed. And I got back back down to my room and they said, well, I saw a flying saucer, it was as big as a house. And the thing that was really good is that a week after I pulled this stunt, there was a flying saucer sighting in about 50 miles from where my school was.
It was a copycat.
And then when I graduated, I brought out the cardboard and tinfoil, the flying saucer, and I said, well, this is what you saw outside your window.
So do you like to play practical jokes?
Well, I'm not doing that kind of stuff now, but that was kind of a practical joke.
Mm-hmm. Temple Grandin, we can't thank you enough. This was wonderful.
That was Temple Grandin talking with Laura Honhold. Temple Grandin's latest book is Calling All Minds, How to Think and Create Like an Inventor. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.